A new year and an old debate about shutting down the government. It's like Groundhog Day, but with policy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, January 2nd. Good to have you with us. And just like anyone else who leaves work at the office over the holidays, Congress returns with a lot of stuff on their collective plate. Notably, they have to pass a bill to fund the government by January 19th. Otherwise, there will be a partial government shutdown, and there are a lot of budget minefields to navigate. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has our story.
If Isaac Boltansky were a betting man, he'd put the odds of a partial government shutdown at 60% for a couple of reasons.
First, there are a slew of complicated and contentious items that have been wrapped into this January 19th funding deadline.
Boltansky is with Compass Point Research and Trading, which provides Washington analysis to Wall Street.
And second, neither side of the aisle appears eager to compromise.
For example, Democrats want Dreamers, undocumented immigrants brought here as children, protected from deportation. But President Trump wants funding for his wall with Mexico in return. Steve Bell is with the Bipartisan Policy Center. He thinks Congress will just give the president money for border security projects.
You can use it for enhanced border security. In other words, if you want to build more of the wall. Or you can use it if you want to have more agents. I think you can make a deal here.
Congress will also have to make deals on defense and non-defense spending levels and funding for disaster relief and the Children's Health Insurance Program. Gregory Walro teaches political science at Columbia University. He says neither party wants a shutdown, and Republicans know if they don't keep the government open when they control Congress and the White House, they risk upsetting Wall Street.
If the market starts to go down, they have a less compelling case about how well they are handling the economy.
The S&P 500 fell around 2% during a government shutdown in 1990. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Staying with Washington and economic policy, back in April, President Trump worried that the dollar was getting too strong. Maybe he didn't need to because it dropped some 10% in 2017, the worst performance in more than a decade. Now, analysts say the dollar could lose even more ground. As Marketplace's Ryan Kailath explains, that has real implications for the U.S. economy.
The conventional wisdom, according to investment manager Michael Farr, is that the value of the dollar is a reflection of America's status in the world, not just our military or geopolitical might,
but also the strength of our economy. So if the U.S. economy is strong, then people want dollars.
That demand drives up the value, or strength, of the dollar. So there are any number of homegrown factors that can move that value. Strong or weak economic growth, interest rates moving up or down. But Neil Dutta of Renaissance Macro Research says right now, the weak dollar's not about us doing badly. It's about other countries doing great.
Primarily, the reason the dollar has sold off this year is because global growth has picked up.
See, a currency's strength or weakness is relative. Strong growth in Europe has boosted the euro, which makes the dollar weak in comparison. And the dollar being cheap compared to other currencies is actually a good thing for U.S. exporters, as it makes their products more attractive abroad. That especially helps manufacturers that ship goods and commodities overseas. Overall, though, says Campbell Harvey of Duke University,
exports, in terms of the proportion of the U.S. economy, are really small.
Namely, exports are about 12% of our GDP versus 38% of Mexico's economy. In Germany, it's 46%. Expectations are the dollar will remain relatively cheap as global growth continues, not to mention uncertainty about the effects of the new tax bill and President Trump's protectionist tendencies, both of which could weigh the dollar down. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, happy music. Details when we do the numbers. We are going to turn to the protests in Iran now that have left more than 20 people dead. These are the country's largest demonstrations since 2009, when millions gathered in the streets of Tehran over election results. This current wave of protests is different, though. It's about economic inequality, and that means the people on the streets come from the working class outside of Tehran.
We wanted to unpack the situation a little bit. Bahman Kalbasi from the BBC's Persian service joins me from Los Angeles. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
So President Trump tweeted today, the people have little food, big inflation, no human rights. Let's take that apart a little bit. Where is he right and where is he wrong?
He's right to say the human rights situation in Iran is atrocious. He's wrong to say that inflation comparatively is very bad because, in fact, one of the reasons President Rouhani was reelected back in May was that inflation under his first term went from something around 30% under Ahmadinejad at the peak of it to less than 10%. On the other hand, the reality is the economy and job creation hasn't been good at all because he needs investment to come in. There is systematic corruption. Lower inflation alone doesn't create jobs. So all those next to each other creates the environment that we see now.
What are the main complaints that we're hearing from the protesters? After all, it's a pretty disparate group of people.
You know, unemployment is number one. Very young population, over 60% under the age of 30, not having enough employment to sustain themselves, to get married, to move on in their lives, creates the environment that is very ready for this kind of protest, especially when they see the massive gap in income and wealth. You have parts of Iranian society that is extremely well off. And at the same time, the government isn't really doing anything that they can feel tangibly. You couple all this together, it's a surprise that we haven't had protests sooner.
After the Iran deal was struck with the Obama administration, there was sort of a hope that international investors might put money into Iran. What has happened now that the Trump administration has come into office? I would imagine there is a lot of uncertainty about making that investment.
Absolutely. So you had a, sort of a rush even in the first months after the nuclear deal, the JCPOA, of big investment and small investment, big oil companies from Total in France all the way to, you know, Boeing, an American company trying to sell commercial airplanes, and they've signed deals. The reality is that all came to a sort of screeching halt as soon as President Trump was elected. So it politically has put the moderates in Iran in a very difficult position, and hardliners very much welcoming it because they can say, aha, told you so, never should have trusted the United States. And the population losing patience in the middle of all this and saying, you know, the heck with it all. We're going to go to the street, risk our lives, and trying to make some sort of a change, even if the prospect of it is somewhat bleak.
Bahman Kalbasi, a reporter for the BBC Persian Service. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Iran produces about 3.8 million barrels of oil a day. Right now, it doesn't look like the protests are affecting the price of crude all that much. But there is so much going on in the oil world that prices came roaring out of the gate as this year got underway. With crude trading at $60 a barrel, the strongest start of a year since 2014. Marketplace's Andy Euler has the story.
Talk to any oil and gas expert, and they'll probably say this word within the first minute.
Volatility.
Barbara Shook covers oil and gas at Energy Intelligence. She's covered the industry for almost 50 years.
It's been volatile since then. I don't know why people keep being surprised about that.
But even she admits market conditions today are especially unpredictable. Protests in Iran, uncertainty about the new tax code, whether OPEC will continue to curb production, and whether fracking in the U.S. will make up that shortage. All that uncertainty has Wall Street polarized around future oil prices. Stephen Shork is a former oil trader, now a consultant. He says investors are getting excited about a jump in prices, while oil drillers are being cautious.
The producer is signaling that $60, high 50s, would certainly appear to be the high of the market, whereas the speculator is betting on prices moving higher.
Either way, Barbara Shook says major oil companies will make money
if they can maintain capital discipline.
That is, not spend on exploring new areas that could take years to produce, like Alaska or parts of the Gulf of Mexico. Eric Smith at Tulane University says the $60 a barrel price can keep companies drilling at full speed where they already are and keep the money flowing.
The capital discipline is not coming from the oil companies. The discipline is coming from the lenders, the people that are putting up the money to support these aggressive drilling programs.
The U.S. is on track for a record year of oil production, but that doesn't greatly reduce volatility, because it's just one of so many changing factors in the global market. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Yes, it's a new year, but California is still digging out from last year's devastating wildfires. It's too early to know how much damage has been done in Southern California, but it's likely to be in the billions of dollars. Add to that another $9 billion in damage from the fires in the wine country up north. The cause of those fires is still unknown, but as KQED's Sam Harnett reports, there's already a legal battle over who should pay for all of it.
On that edge over there, those were all houses right along that black fence there. Yeah.
Dennis Hunter is walking through rows and rows of burned out greenhouses. His cannabis farm is on the outskirts of Santa Rosa, and the fire has destroyed much of it. Hunter estimates $500,000 to $600,000 in damages.
We had some people here when the fire came through, so we had already heard from them, and they said the place was on fire as they were running out of it.
Like many of his neighbors, Hunter has been approached by lawyers who want him to sue the local utility, Pacific Gas and Electric, or PG&E. Some law firms have taken out ads on Google to solicit clients.
One group dropped off a whole, like, brochure.
Several firms have already filed lawsuits, alleging that PG&E did not properly maintain its infrastructure. The state hasn't determined the cause of the fire, but if PG&E is found liable for things like failing to maintain power lines or adequately trim trees, it'll have to cover the damages, says Jim Bushnell. He's a professor of economics at the University of California at Davis.
If the utility screwed up, the owners of the utility should be responsible for the costs.
PG&E is investor-owned, which means shareholders would end up paying. It's illegal to charge ratepayers. But Bushnell says utilities are now pushing regulators to change that. They want the costs of wildfires and lawsuits to be considered part of delivering electricity in California. Here's the question utilities are posing, says Bushnell.
Is getting sued for fires just an ordinary aspect of being in the electricity delivery service, or is this something that reflects a negligent or somehow irresponsible action by the utility?
Mark Levine is a state assemblyman from the Bay Area, and he says the burden should not fall on ratepayers.
In no way should people who have had their houses burned down or who have had neighbors lose lives, should they have to pay increased rates because of the negligence of utilities.
Levine is one of several lawmakers introducing a bill to make it even harder for state utilities to have ratepayers cover the cost of fire damage. This cause just had a big victory. Administrative law judges ruled that a utility in San Diego could not pass on $379 million in damages from a fire in 2007.
We've seen in multiple fires and tragedies that utilities are looking to compensate by increasing rates.
A spate of fires has ripped through the drought-ridden West Coast in recent years, which has cost utilities billions. In a written statement, PG&E says, "Wildfires pose real risks to our entire state's economy and infrastructure. Given these devastating effects of climate change, this is a vital statewide safety issue that impacts every person and community in the state." Those suing PG&E say the utility should be doing more when it comes to safety.
My name is Gregory Wilson.
Wilson is one of over 300 plaintiffs suing the utility, and he has to whisper because of smoke damage to his vocal cords. At a press conference, Wilson told reporters how he and his wife survived the Santa Rosa fires this fall by hiding in their pool.
What happened was we basically jumped in the pool to survive.
And they watched everything burn around them.
And many times had to dive underwater with the superheated air and embers flying over us.
Lawsuits from residents like Wilson continue to pile up, but they may be in limbo for quite a while. We still don't know what caused the fires this fall, and the state says it will be at least a few months before it concludes its investigation. In Santa Rosa, I'm Sam Harnett for Marketplace.
Coming up.
In economic terms, this is the most horrible business plan you could ever create.
Oh, yeah. It's the rescue dog economy. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed 104 points, 0.4% to close at 24,824. The NASDAQ jumped 101 points, 1.4% to finish at 7,004. And the S&P 500 increased 21 points, 0.8% to end at 2,694. As U.S. markets reopen for the year, the holiday retail picture gets clearer. It's looking like a pretty one. Macy's grew 4.4%, Amazon lifted 1.6%, and JCPenney took a big jump up, 10.7%. New Year's resolutions, anyone? Weight Watchers hope so. It has a new social media ambassador, DJ Khaled. He'll promote the company to his millions of followers. Weight Watcher shares tipped up the scale. Yes, really, 8%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.45%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Maybe you spent the last few weeks of December frantically running around a shopping mall. If so, the retailers of America thank you, because it turns out they had a pretty good holiday season after a meh year. Holiday sales were up almost 5% over last year, according to MasterCard's Spending Pulse. To break it all down, we have journalist Elizabeth Holmes, who covers retail. Welcome.
Hey, Lizzie.
You know, it looks like we actually had a pretty good holiday retail season. Some sales up as much as 5% this year. I mean, how big of a deal is this season?
You know, early indications are that people were feeling really good this holiday shopping season. They're feeling better about their personal financial situation, and they wanted to sort of get out and spread a little holiday cheer and open their wallets. So, retailers are excited. It's the best year-over-year growth since 2011, according to early numbers.
Do we have a sense what drove those numbers, whether we're talking about the sort of feeling of economic well-being or bonuses, wages, anything like that?
I think it's a combination of things. I think people are feeling better about the sort of overall economy and as well their personal situation. What I would say is that this is not necessarily a green light for retailers here, that they still have some struggles ahead in 2018. A lot of the spending went towards experiences, you know, people wanting to take someone out to dinner or buy a plane ticket and go on vacation, that kind of thing, rather than buy something to wrap and put under the tree.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you how we square this season with, you know, the other big retail trend, which is like the death of the mall, the death of the brick and mortar store. How do they go together?
Absolutely. So, you know, 2017 was a real rocky road for a lot of retailers, especially in the apparel sector, which I follow pretty closely. Department stores in particular had a really hard time. And so as we see these really, you know, positive numbers for a lot of categories, that's happening in electronics. It's happening for some in jewelry. But apparel seems to continue to struggle a little bit. And I would say that going forward, retailers have to continue to fight that urge to promote and discount everything as much as they have been, because the shopper is still obviously very addicted to discounting. And they've got to up their retail experience to bring people into the stores.
I'm really curious about this sort of tie-in effect. So I'm going to admit and out my mother here. She gave me an Instant Pot for Christmas, this like multi-cooker thing.
Yes.
It was the gift of the season, but along with a pretty sophisticated cookbook that goes with it. Can we spin out from that anecdote a sense of not just the hot gifts, but how you really package them in this modern kind of way of, here's the experience that's going to go along with it?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's the real win for retailers. If they can get you in the door to buy not just what you had on your list, but something that makes it feel a little more special and a little more personal. So your mom really, really, really went for it there. And I think, you know, that's what all retailers want. They don't want to just sell you a sweater. They want to sell you a scarf to go with it, kind of thing. And I think what, in particular about the Instant Pot, it is a chance to do something, right? It's not just, you know, you buy a sweater and you wear it once, but you can, if you have that cookbook, you can enjoy it throughout the year. You can try different things. It makes it more than just sort of a one-off gift. It makes it something that has a little longevity to it.
Elizabeth Holmes covers retail trends, fashion, and style. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
story about supply and demand, and also dogs, who are being moved from the rural south to cities in the north where they are adopted. I recently sat down with Joy Harkleroad, who rescues dogs in Marion, North Carolina, and I asked her why there are so many adoptable dogs in the south to begin with.
Because there's no spay-neuter law, no leash law, and we tried for years to get one, but every time we try, we get stopped.
There are objections from hunters, from people who say spay and neuter laws are government overreach, or that it's just too expensive in low-income places. And that's led to thousands of dogs going north, where marketplace producer Peter Balanon Rosen picked up our story in Newington, Connecticut.
So before we get to the puppies, meet Gordon Willard.
I'm the executive director here at the Connecticut Humane Society,
where the dogs from North Carolina have just arrived. Willard's been in this biz since 1983. Back then, across the Northeast,
we were dealing with surplus animals. We had oversupply and under demand.
Back then, the Connecticut Humane Society processed over 40,000 local animals each year. But then, in the mid-90s, something changed. All of a sudden, fewer homeless dogs.
Which meant spaying and neutering was working.
New rules across New England made owners sterilize their pets. But just as fewer dogs got to shelters, demand for them shot up. Why? Well, a few reasons. One, spay-neuter rules meant fewer people adopting out unwanted litters. Two, it also meant fewer strays. And three, purebred dogs and their puppy mill associations were not so cool anymore.
And the word rescue took on a different connotation.
Then Hurricane Katrina hit. In 2005, Northeast Humane Groups pooled resources to transport dogs from New Orleans. It showed them, whoa, we can bring dogs from other places, disaster or no. And by 2016, Connecticut organizations were bringing up about 20,000 animals a year from out of state. Today, about one in every 10 comes here to the Connecticut Humane Society.
Hey,
good morning.
Good morning.
Staff and volunteers get ready, putting on bright blue scrubs. I suit up, too.
Get our gloves on, and then we'll start taking dogs off as soon as the vet comes.
There's a whole process to this. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has 23 pages of regulations for how to handle and transport dogs. Inside the van, dogs wait. The unloading process, it's a choreography, one dog at a time. I meet this little rat terrier. She's white with pointy black ears, and her name's Abby. She's terrified, pees herself as volunteer Steve Wolbert picks her up. They clean that up and take Abby for a walk. Little by little, you see the transformation. Abby goes from trembling to sniffing around the lawn. She even jumps at a tree.
That's my girl. You ready to go in and take a look at the vet? Let's go.
Turn her around, and we're going to just look at her knees and look at her skin.
Vet Kaylin Machewski examines every dog.
She looks good.
She does. Let's go, Abs.
Abby heads to an area where transport dogs stay for 48 hours before joining other dogs up for adoption. Now, with all of this, there are costs. The medical exams down south, the transport, and this processing. Connecticut Humane Society foots the bill for all of it, and it adds up. Again, Director Gordon Willard.
In economic terms, this is the most horrible business plan you could ever create.
Can you put a dollar figure to how much you spend on each dog?
About a net figure, we're looking about $900 subsidy per animal adopted.
Adoption fees range from $100 for older dogs to $445 for puppies. Willard says the shelter stays open because of their donors, not money from adoptions. Staff say most of the transport dogs will be adopted out within the week. And they say, like every year, when the time comes, they'll crunch the numbers, go through their books, and make sure transport is something they plan to continue. I'm Peter Balanon Rosen for Marketplace.
If you want to listen to our Marketplace weekend story about moving dogs from the south to the north, plus see some really cute pictures of rescue dogs, just go to our website, marketplace.org. This final note before we go today. Does the secret to keeping your New Year's resolution lie in temptation? Well, kinda. Behavioral scientist Catherine Milkman wrote today in the Washington Post about bundling together a goal, say, hopping on the Stairmaster, with something that tempts you, listening to a cheesy audiobook, perhaps. If you let yourself do them together, something she calls temptation bundling, you might be almost one-third more likely to stick to the whole Stairmaster thing. Good luck, everyone. Today, the Dow climbed 104 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ jumped 103 points, 1.5%. And the S&P 500 increased 22 points, 0.8%. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Ben Heathcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Modi is our executive director of digital. Sitara Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. See you all tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.